Hey everyone, and welcome back to Inside the Morgue, the show that gives you all the real details of what really happens during an autopsy. We're your hosts and lovely autopsy techs, Jess and Alice. This week, by popular demand, we're watching the pilot episode of iZombie. This has been highly requested by you guys, and we are excited to dive into it.
So we open on a doctor in an ER with a voiceover of her saying that this was her life before she died. She manages to save a boy's life, and after working hours, we get to see that she is like invited to a party by a colleague who she thought hated her, but turns out she doesn't hate her.
I feel that on a level where it's like, I think people hate me, and they're like, no.
It's like, you're the life of the party.
I'm like, they invite me somewhere, and I'm like, but you still hate me, right? And they're like, no, what's wrong with you?
You're doing this because you hate me.
Yeah.
Our protagonist for the show, Liv, turns down this invite to spend the night with her fiancé, but he's like, no, girl, go party, and, like, let me know how it goes. So she ends up...
Such a supportive... He's a Ken.
He is a Ken.
He's supporting his Barbie. He was hyping her up, too, when she came out.
He was like, we have our whole life. It's like, go party, girl.
Yeah.
Adorable. So she obviously goes to this party because her lovely fiancé was like, yes, go, and hyping her up. So we cut to all hell breaking loose at a boat party, and it's a zombie outbreak. So our protagonist, Liv, wakes up on the beach in a body bag, and she suddenly has a white streak of hair and a nasty scratch on her arm. Her voiceover tells us that she has the sudden desire to eat brains. And there are so many other bodies on the beach in body bags, and an EMT is in the distance, like clearly he's very startled when she wakes up. And then immediately we cut to her at a grocery store buying tons of self-tanner because she's a zombie now, and she immediately became deathly pale, and she has a copy of Night of the Living Dead.
It's one of my favorite movies. It's a classic.
I don't think I've actually ever seen it.
It's an older movie. It's good. It's good. Okay. It's a classic zombie flick.
Maybe
it's
this great. Halloween we'll have a watch party.
Yeah! I think you'd like it.
I probably would. So Liv goes home and she's talking to her roommate, who tells her that they want to reinstate something called Potluck Tuesdays and that the roommates can hang out and bond like they used to. I don't know if we prefaced this in the beginning. She was a doctor. Like,
yes.
She was like in her residency at the hospital that she was working at. So she kind of like abruptly ended that, and her roommate is very concerned.
Yeah. And her hair is totally white now, so she looks very... Yeah. She looks emo. Like, people tell her, like, she looks emo, and everybody's worried about her. And I'm like, hey, maybe she just wanted to go blonde and be pale.
But it's no, a choice.
Also, her roommate is played by Ali Mishaka of Ali and AJ and Phil of the Future fame.
She's an amazing actress. I love her.
I love her so much, and I love her music. Like, I love Ali and AJ, like, unironically.
Yeah.
Love them so much.
The roommate, it turns out, this is, like, a ruse. Potluck Tuesdays is a ruse, and it turns out that it's really an intervention for Liv. Her roommate's there, her now ex-fiancé, because she ended that, and her mom and her brother are all in her house. Her mom tells her that they are concerned about her new behavior, that it's increasingly unlike her, and she's shocked that her daughter had left her prestigious ER residency for a, quote, job in the morgue. Why do people hate on morgue workers?
It's always the case in these shows where people don't work in forensics because they want to. It's like they fall into it, or like something terrible happened to them and now they like have to settle for forensics. Uh-huh. And I'm like, some of us want to be here. Like, some of us worked very hard to be here.
This isn't my fallback option. Yeah. This wasn't like plan D.
Yeah. Also, she's still a doctor. She's doing like a residency in a morgue. Mm-hmm. So it's not... Yeah, she's... I don't know why the mom just hates on the morgue.
The mom is hating on her because she, I think it's like below her at this point.
I'm not a fan of the mom. I'm not a fan.
So Liv's mom also tells her that she will regret breaking off her engagement with her former fiancé. His name is Major.
Who's just like right in the room too.
Right? It's like, hey.
He's like, sorry, I was told this wasn't going to be brought up.
And her roommate tells her that they're concerned that she has PTSD after that party.
I mean, she said that.
I probably would, too. And she said that after what Liv had went through on the lake, which she describes as a bunch of drunks starting to kill each other, and then a fire starting, she has been through a lot, and she should seek professional help. She says she doesn't think she needs professional help, but she does say that she will volunteer at the children's haunted house her mom is putting on, just like she used to. Liv then heads into work in the morgue. When she gets there, the doc is eating right over the dead body. This might be a potential red flag, because that's a major biohazard.
I don't eat in the morgue. I don't drink in the morgue. I have seen people bring coffee into the morgue. But they
never drink their coffee over the body. They leave it on, like, our designated clean area table.
Yeah, with, like, the computer and stuff. But, yeah. Yeah, he was, like, up against the body of the table, eating it's cereal. He's just slurping on his cereal. Yeah. I'm like, what? Also, I gotta get the actor's name. He's played by an actor that I love, who I know from...
He's so popular
All
now.
Of the Mike Flanagan things. He plays Dr. Ravi. Rahul Kohli. I love him. He's like...
He's awesome.
He's a favorite of mine in any Mike Flanagan thing that I watch, and I watch a lot of Mike Flanagan things. So, yeah.
Because they're all so good, too.
They're all so good, and they're also all on Netflix, just like iZombie. So.
Yep.
If you're a fan of him, check out other things that he's in.
So this might be a potential red flag, just for the biohazardness of it. But Dr. Ravi calls her over to see a rectus sheath contusion that he claims looks just like the Virgin Mary holding a lay pall. So a rectus sheath contusion, or hematoma, is an accumulation of blood in the sheath of the rectus abdominis, and this is secondary to a rupture of the epigastric vessel or a muscle tear, and this could occur spontaneously or after trauma.
He also debates, like, Instagramming it. He's like, I shouldn't Instagram this, right? And she's like, no. I'm like, what?
don't even get me on a rant starting about problematic pages on Instagram posting things they probably shouldn't post.
Yeah.
But he then asks her her, quote, favorite question. He asks Liv in the 5 months that she's worked in the morgue, what's the weirdest thing that she's seen? She answers that him drinking cereal milk over a corpse is pretty weird. I agree.
Valid.
So the doc tells her that the body they're looking at today is a Jane Doe that was found in the back of a garbage truck. The driver isn't sure where he picked her up, and there's no leads on an ID or fingerprints yet, and the garbage truck was using a crusher, so that complicates the cause of death. The doc gets called about a suicide, so he tells Liv to sew the body up and bag her and box her. We don't box our bodies, just as clarification.
I was wondering, I mean, I understood what the bag her meant, but the box her I didn't get, but I think, so, they have one of the classic morgue cooler, like, mortuary wall coolers, so I'm wondering if that's what he meant by box her, like, put her back in the wall.
Box her in the box cooler.
Put her back in the box cooler in the wall.
That makes sense.
I didn't see the box cooler until a later scene, and this is all just clicking now, so I'm thinking out loud, and I could be wrong, but that would be my best guess, because I was like, box?
That makes total sense.
Boxer. And
I was like, I was thinking, like, a whole cremation box.
That was my
box.
First thought.
Like, literally, like, a life-size box that people put, that you would be put in if you were going to get cremated.
Yeah, it's like a big cardboard box. And, like, sometimes if the funeral home is coming to pick up a body and they know it's a cremation, they'll just bring the cremation box and put the body right in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was my first thought, too, when he said box her. I was like, what? I was like, if she's a suspected homicide, they shouldn't be cremating her right away. Like, what? And then I clicked. I was like, oh, maybe
the
he
box
means, like,
cooler makes a lot more sense.
Box cooler type thing. That's my best guess.
Uh-huh. So after the doc leaves, Liv picks up the bone saw and cuts into the skull without peeling the scalp first, which is also a big red flag. We've talked about this in a past episode where they did this.
It was bones.
Just sawing straight into the forehead. That's not how we do it. We've talked about how we do it before, so we're not going to go into detail.
To be fair to iZombie, this one wasn't as egregious as bones, because we don't actually see her go right into the skin. of the forehead. But, like, she didn't peel the scalp. We saw the Jane Doe with her scalp intact already, and we just see her start the bone saw and lower it. So we can imagine. Whereas on Bones, they just straight up show you cutting straight into the bone sawing into forehead the forehead without peeling the scalp first. And I'm like, no!
What are you doing?
I can't have a funeral, right? Like, I can't have a viewing now. You just saw straight into their forehead.
Oh my God. We also see her bring the brain that she just took out, and she puts it into the scale to weigh it. I think I want to give another red flag for this brain.
Oh, the brain looked really bad. I was just going to say, I liked that they showed the scale, because that's like exactly
that
what
was
our
cool.
scale looked
That's something
like.
We don't always see in shows.
Yeah. But yeah, the brain did look a little, it looked like a Halloween decoration.
So I might give an impromptu red flag for the way the brain looked.
I support you. I support you.
You're right. It looked like a really bad Halloween, like a mom was trying to make a gelatin brain for a Halloween party.
Which, like, I've heard that's hard to do. So I'm still, like, I feel like I'm spoiled by that one Body of Proof episode that we watched where the brain just looked so real. I'm like, uh-huh. I'm constantly comparing every brain I see in these shows to that brain. And I don't think anything's ever going to compare. Like, to the point where I'm wondering if they used a real brain in that show. It looks so good.
Maybe they use, I know in Grey's Anatomy, they use, like, a lot of animal, like, aortas and, like, pig aortas and stuff. Maybe it was an animal's brain.
I didn't know they did that in Grey's Anatomy. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Like, all of the scenes that you see, like, when they're, like, cutting into the body, a lot of it's like animal organs.
I've never really watched a ton of Grey's Anatomy, but that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Maybe they did.
So maybe it was an animal's brain that Body of Proof used.
Oh my God, I'm going to go in a rabbit hole later trying to figure out if that was an animal brain that we saw in that episode. Stay tuned, everybody. I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
Anyway, back to this episode. She then microwaves a cup of ramen noodles, mixes in the brains, adds some hot sauce, and eats it. Her voiceover reveals that to the audience that she is, in fact, a zombie. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I know. The name of the show just gave it away.
We see her sitting in the morgue eating her lunch of ramen and brains while watching Night of the Living Dead, which is a classic. And suddenly, Dr. Ravi walks back in and says he has a lot of questions for her. He seems surprisingly almost unbothered, and his first question of asking why she chose to put hot sauce on the brain, and she just says, like, oh, is it like a zombie thing? And then we cut to the doctor doing an inspection of Liv and explaining that everyone is familiar with the massacre on the lake. He said that he was working that night and noticed that a lot of people that died in the incident were missing significant brain mass. His colleague thought that this was due to fish in the lake, but he didn't think that that was the case.
He called a red flag on that.
He did.
He's like, fish eating brains, really?
He knows better. Mm-hmm. He says that this is a virus like rabies, but worse. Liv asks if she's getting fired, and the doc just says that he has so many questions for her. So she's not. He says that he suspected Liv since she finished an autopsy on a murder victim for him, but that later a detective needed him to reopen this body, and he noticed that only a part of the brain was missing. He says that after he confirmed Liv was involved in the lake massacre, he started opening all of the cases that she finished for him and found that all of the decedent's brains were missing. He also takes her heart rate and finds that it is 10 beats per minute, which is very below average, and if that wasn't obvious.
Yeah, I think it's like between 60 and 80 is like the average for an adult.
She asks why he isn't freaked out, and he's shocked that he's the first one to know that she's a zombie, and says that she must be lonely. He confesses that he used to work at the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control, and that they fired him because they got tired of his constant warnings about a zombie outbreak that was coming. He says he thinks that this is a man-made plague and a form of biological warfare. He says that on the boat that night, people were doing this new designer drug called Utopium. And Liv says she didn't try this drug, but that the crazy thing is she usually never went to parties.
So we then see a flashback to the party, and someone offers her Utopium, and she turns them down. She turns to see all hell break loose, and then she turns back around, and the person who offered her the drugs originally suddenly looks very zombie-like. He grabs her arm violently, causing the scratch, and she ends up pulling away and falling off the boat. The next thing she remembers is waking up in a body bag. She keeps explaining to the doc that she tries to eat brains as infrequently as possible. If she doesn't, she gets dumber and meaner. She also explains the hot sauce by saying that she can't taste anything unless it's really spicy. A detective then walks in and asks if they have anything on the Jane Doe. The doc says that they didn't get anything on the prince and that he'll try dental records next. So this is a possible green flag. Because, yeah, I think that would be the next logical step. Like, if you don't get a hit on prince, you got to start thinking what else you can do. If you don't have access to, like, DNA, like a rapid DNA, dental.
Yeah.
Dental would be the next step.
That's definitely what we would do.
So Dr. Ravi asked the detective if they found anything in the dumpster, and he pulls out a set of handcuffs, and he says that they're novelty and not a police issue. When Liv sees the handcuffs, she suddenly has a vision. She sees from the point of view of the Jane Doe that a man arrested her for shoplifting at a convenience store in Canada. She snaps out of it. The detective is asking if the blunt force trauma the victim suffered wasn't just from the garbage truck crushing her skull, and Liv interrupts by saying that the Jane Doe had been arrested in the past for shoplifting in Canada in 2008. The detective asks how Liv got such a specific hunch out of nowhere, and Dr. Ravi looks up on the system and finds a woman named Stephanie Germanotta, who was arrested for shoplifting in November 2008 that looks just like their Jane Doe. The fingerprints match, and they find the Jane Doe's identity. So this detective asks if they're messing with him and asks Liv for a straight answer. Dr. Ravi covers for her and tells the detective that she's just a psychic. And the detective, I think, still thinks they're messing with him and because he's new at this job and just leaves. After he leaves, Liv tells Dr. Ravi that after she eats a brain, she gets visions or dreams of the person's life. Dr. Ravi asks if he can run some cognitive tests on her and collect some saliva samples before she leaves for the day. We then cut to Liv at home and find out that she hasn't been able to sleep for 5 months since the Lake Massacre. She goes to help her mother at the children's haunted house when somebody comes running by screaming, and she has a flashback of this Stephanie Germanotta being attacked by a man in a ski mask saying, "Here's Johnny," and taking off the mask. Liv is able to recognize this man as someone named Johnny Frost, who was a local meteorologist. She tells Dr. Ravi this, and he tells her that she needs to tell the detective. She doesn't want to and says she has a hard enough time pretending to be alive, and she doesn't know how she's going to keep up with this psychic routine that he made up. But Dr. Ravi says that since Liv ate this girl's brain, she at least owes it to her to get her murderer caught. So she ends up going to the precinct and seeing the detective, and he's getting laughed at by his colleagues. He comes over and tells her that the name that they gave for his Jane Doe case, Stephanie Germanotta, is actually Lady Gaga's legal name. I will say that was the first thing I thought. Like, as soon as they said Stephanie Germanotta, I'm like, Lady Gaga? I was like, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody in the show is a huge Lady Gaga fan and, like, just thought this is a cute nod. And then it's revealed that the Jane Doe gave a fake name to police when she was arrested for shoplifting in 2008.
I don't remember when the show premiered, but maybe Lady Gaga was, like, at the peak of her career, and they're like, oh, we gotta add it in.
Yeah. I am a huge Lady Gaga fan, so as soon as they said that, I was like, Gaga? What? They have, like, detectives singing, like, Bad Romance in the background. So, Liv tells the detective that she saw a vision of Johnny Frost attacking their victim. He isn't buying it and tells her that she has to come with him to go talk to the weatherman. So they go to the news station and the detective shows Johnny Frost a photo of their victim. Johnny looks taken aback and like he recognizes her but denies knowing her. He also says that if they have any other questions for him, he's going to want a lawyer present. As he goes to walk away, Liv says quietly, "Here's Johnny." And he walks back and asks if Liv recorded his, quote, sessions. He goes on to say that he is a beloved public figure and asks if there's anything he can do to just make this go away. The detective says that murder isn't something that you can just let slide. And at this, Johnny seems genuinely surprised and shocked and asks if Tatiana is actually dead. He does have an alibi for the night of the murder. He was at the station all day, reporting at 6 and again at 11. But the detective says that they need to know everything he knows about this Tatiana. So back at the precinct, Johnny is showing them Tatiana's call girl website. She offers a role play option, and he says that they often role played as a housewife and an intruder, which is the vision that Liv saw. He asks the detective if they've talked to Tess yet, and tells them that Tess is her friend, who sometimes does sessions with her. Back at the morgue, Liv and the doc are watching Night of the Living Dead, and the detective walks in and says that he made an appointment with Tess, and he wants Liv to come along to see if she can have any more visions. Liv doesn't want to go, but Dr. Ravi convinces her that she should, and says that helping with the investigation is part of their job. They go to Tess's apartment, and when Tess opens the door, she says it's going to cost double for two. But then the detective flashes his badge, and Tess pretends she doesn't know English and starts speaking in Romanian, which Liv can understand and speak fluently back, to everyone's surprise, including her own. Tess's neighbor from across the hall, whose name is Truman, comes out and asks if Tess is all right, and Tess tells him she's fine and to go back inside. The detective asks Tess about Tatiana, and she asks what Tatiana has done this time to get into trouble. So they end up telling her that Tatiana was murdered and ask when the last time they saw her was. Tess obviously gets upset at this news and says she doesn't know anything and closes her door. Through the closed door, the detective says that they need her help and that they don't even know Tatiana's full name. So we hear her sobbing behind the door, and Tess eventually tells him that Tatiana's full name was Tatiana Corzo. The detective and Liv go to Tatiana's address, and it's in a very nice neighborhood. The landlord lets them into the apartment, and he says he knew what she did for a living, but that he didn't care because she always paid rent on time. The place looks ransacked, but nothing valuable seems to be missing, so it doesn't seem like it was a robbery. Liv finds Tatiana's phone and sees that Tess tried calling her the day she died. They play the voicemail, and it's in Romanian, but Liv is able to translate, and Tess was saying, "Hey, you little klepto, get your ass back up to the suite, or we are never going to work with you again."
When the detective ghost to open the window, Liv has another vision. She has a vision of a man holding Tatiana out the window, demanding for his ring back, even though Tatiana denies having it. She slips out of the man's grip and falls to her death out of the window. They go back to Tessa's apartment, but she isn't there. Their neighbor, Truman, says that she ran away after their visit. Liv tells him that one girl's already dead and they're trying to stop another from happening. Truman says that Tess didn't say where she was going, but she had a few suitcases with her and asked him to get mail while she was gone. He asks if the dead girl was Monica. When they ask who Monica was, he says that it was a friend of Tess's who came around a lot. They ask if she worked with Tess, and he says he hopes she didn't because she looked like a kid to him. Liv looks up Tatiana's website and finds Monica and confirms with Truman that this is the girl that he was referring to. She goes to leave and says that they have to find Monica. She tells the detective that after seeing and feeling Tatiana die, this is personal to her now. Back at the morgue, the doc is telling Liv that it's okay to help the detective find the murderer. He's also running preliminary tests on Liv's blood by treating it with different bacteria, and he wants to know more about the virus she has, so he's testing it to see how it defends itself. He says he wants to know more so that he can cure it. Liv is shocked and touched that he's going to try to cure her. Back at the precinct, the sergeant tells the detective that he's giving Tatiana's case to someone else. The detective tries to argue by saying that he has leads on all the girls connected to Tatiana, and that he knows Tatiana was killed by one of her Johns who thought that she stole his ring. He says he saw that one of the girls logged into her online economics class an hour ago, and he found an IP address, and the computer forensics team is working on getting a location for him at the moment. The sergeant still gives the case away, but still asks the original detective to lead up with some interviews with Tess's neighbor and the weatherman, and Liv goes to the precinct to talk to this detective, but he's out. This other detective who's taking over the case, Detective Pratt, gets the call with Monica's address from computer forensics and leaves to go find her. Liv leaves the precinct and goes back to the morgue to find the original detective. His name is Detective Babineau, and Babineau tells her that he talked to Johnny Frost again, and he said that Tatiana told him she had something called a barbos de porc. Liv translates this to mean bearded pig in Romanian, and the detective realizes that she meant a bearded cop, or a detective, which fits the description of Detective Pratt, who took over this case. He realizes Pratt wanted Babineau off the case before he solved it, and they go back to the precinct to get the address for the girls that Pratt went to go find. Babineau calls for backup, but isn't getting an immediate response. We see Pratt in the house with two girls. He has them tied up to chairs with plastic sheets around.
It was very Dexter.
It was.
With, like, the plastic sheets everywhere, I was like, oh, this is a kill room. This is bad.
He explains that the ring he had missing is his wedding ring, and he needs it back before his wife gets back from her trip to Boca. He pulls out his gun, and Tess tells him that Tatiana was the one who always stole things, and she couldn't help it. He says he knows it wasn't her because he saw the look in her eye right before he killed her. Monica then confesses to pawning the ring. She says she needed the money for school and that she knew Tatiana would get the blame because she always steals things. Pratt says that it's Monica's fault that Tatiana died and that he couldn't live in a one-bedroom apartment while his wife got half his salary. Babineau arrives and approaches the scene slowly. Tess sees him, which causes Pratt to turn around and tries to shoot him. He misses, and Babineau is able to break in and chase Pratt down. Liv's waiting in the car outside and sees Pratt escaping through the window. She blocks the driveway with the car so that Pratt can't get out, but then he goes to the car and tells her to get out or he'll shoot her. Liv doesn't move, and Pratt shoots her, drags her out of the car, and drives off. Babineau sees all of this happening from inside the house, and he runs out to help, but Liv isn't there when he gets outside. We cut to Pratt driving off, and a hand smashes through the windshield. Liv is now on top of the car. She grabs the steering wheel and causes the car to crash. Pratt is ejected from the car, and Liv gets thrown from the roof. She sits up, and her eyes are red, and she goes to eat Pratt's brains. But Babineau just caught up and called out for her, and then she suddenly, like, snaps out of her zombiness. He says he saw her get shot, but she lies and tells him that Pratt missed, and then she just chased the car down. Babineau tells her that the girls are safe and then arrests Pratt. So, back in the morgue, Liv is explaining all of this to Robbie, that she got mad and became 99% zombie. The doctor removes the bullet from her heart just as she's, like, sitting on the chair. He's just removing the bullet casually. So this episode ends with Liv helping out in the haunted house with her family and friends, and she's dressed as a zombie for Halloween.
I thought that was a cute ending. And I also love how much she's gaslighting Babineau right now. Like,
right?
We see it from his point of view in the show, and it's like, you see her, like, get shot, like, in the face and, like, pulled out of the car. Well, she gets shot in the chest. Not in the face. But she gets shot and, like, dragged out of a car. She's like, nah, he missed. I was fine and I ran. And he's like...
She was like, oh, I played dead.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really good at playing dead because I am a zombie.
I am dead.
I am dead. I'm not playing. But I really enjoyed this show. I thought it was really fun.
I watched the show probably up to, like, one of the later seasons, and this was kind of nostalgic to kind of rewatch, and I forgot how fun it is.
I am genuinely putting this in, like, one of my rotations as, like, a show that I just, one of my shows that I'm watching now, because it was a lot of fun. I love zombie lore, zombie media, and obviously forensics, yeah. And this is combining both of those things. Although, we don't solve cases like she does. We don't eat brains, guys. Unless they're made of Jello
at a Halloween party.
I actually hate Jello, but maybe I'd eat it for fun. So, iZombie's premise that a drug could turn people into flesh-eating zombies made us think of another drug that was making headlines in 2012, bath salts. So in 2012 in Miami, it was reported that a man named Rudy Eugene had attacked another man named Ronald Popo and was biting parts of his face off. The attacker was shot by police after they tried pleading with him and only got growls in response. The theory was that the attacker was high on something called bath salts. So these drugs can produce a meth-like high and sometimes cause violent behavior in users. Other people on bath salts were reported to have episodes of superhuman strength, and according to Armando Aguilar, who was the president of the Miami Fraternal Order of Police, he said that bath salt users became violent and would be burning up from the inside. He said that their organs would reach levels that most would die at, and he said at the time police would approach them and they'd seem like they were the walking dead. So bath salts cover several synthetic chemicals, including mefedrone and MDPV, which is, I'm going to butcher this, methyl methylbenzoxytrolvaline, nailed it, something like that. MDPV, guys, if you want to look it up. And so these synthetic chemicals will give a stimulant high similar to meth or cocaine. The DEA reported that people who abuse these substances have reported agitation, insomnia, irritability, dizziness, depression, paranoia, delusions, suicidal ideations, seizures, and panic attacks. Users have also reported effects including impaired perception of reality, reduced motor control, and decreased ability to think clearly. Rudy Eugene's girlfriend, who preferred to stay anonymous, said in an interview that the man being depicted in the media as a face eater and a monster was not the man she knew. She said he did smoke marijuana often, though he had recently stated he wanted to quit, and he didn't use stronger recreational drugs and even refused to take over-the-counter medications for simple ailments like headaches. She said he was sweet and well-mannered, and she believes that Rudy Eugene was unknowingly drugged. She said the only other explanation would be something supernatural, like a voodoo curse. She had not believed in voodoo until this incident. And toxicology reports from Eugene's autopsy only reported a small amount of marijuana in his system. The autopsy revealed no human flesh in Eugene's gastric contents, but a number of undigested pills were recovered that were unable to be identified. Toxicologist Barry Logan said Eugene's behavior was consistent with bath salts and theorized that maybe the new drug was not able to be tested for. Ronald Popo, the man who was attacked, was admitted to Jackson Memorial Hospital in critical condition with 75 to 80% of his face above his beard missing and his left eye gouged out. He underwent facial reconstruction surgeries that took months to complete, but he remains permanently blind. Popo lost his eyebrows, his nose, parts of his forehead and cheeks, and his left eye. In July of 2012, Popo spoke to police and said that Eugene approached him in a friendly manner, but then complained that he couldn't, quote, score at the beach and, quote, souped up on something, started talking about how they were all going to die. He then accused Popo of stealing his Bible and suddenly attacked him. A fund was set up to help pay for Popo's medical costs, which raised $100,700. After rehabilitation, he put back on 50 pounds and relearned how to dress, feed himself, shower, and shave. We were able to get this information from an NPR article titled Bath Salt Drug Suspected in Miami Face-Eating Attack by Mark Memmott, as well as the Wikipedia page for this incident, and both of these will be linked in our show notes if you want to read more.
That whole incident was just insane.
I remember it being all over the news.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I ever heard of bath salts. I feel like that was the first.
It was all over Twitter at the time.
Yeah. I was in 2012. I would have been finishing my freshman year in college. It was 2012. Oh my God, don't even tell me how little you were. Were you in like eighth grade? You were in eighth grade, weren't you? You were in eighth grade.
Yeah. I graduated eighth grade in 2012.
It's so weird when we talk about it in like that and like those terms, because like now that we're like in our 20s and 30s, it's, our age gap isn't that huge of a deal. But like, if you had told 19-year-old Alice in college and introduced her to this eighth grader and was like, "This is gonna be one of your best friends," I'd be like, "What?"
We're asking Kutcher, am I being pranked?
This person in the future. And be like, excuse me, this child?
Oh my God. I know, it's so funny.
It's so crazy to me. But look at us now.
Look at it, we've come so far.
You're going to have a podcast with this person, and they introduce 19-year-old me to little 14-year-old Jess, and I'm like, what's a podcast? But yeah, I remember this, sidetracking majorly, but I remember this being all over the news. When I was a freshman, I feel bad for, I mean everybody involved, but like they had a quote from Rudy Eugene, who was the man that attacked the other man, for his family and his loved ones, because like his girlfriend was saying like that's not the man they know, and now everybody knows him as like a quote zombie. Yeah, it definitely got like, that was how it was portrayed in the media. It was like there was a zombie attack because it was just so sensationalized. And it's like, no, maybe he was drugged or maybe some. I mean, I'm really glad that Ronald's Papo was able to make a recovery too. Mm-hmm. That's an awful attack.
I had no idea how severe his face was, like, torn apart.
I also did not know until I was reading this article how bad it was. I didn't know he was permanently blind. Like, he completely lost his left eye, and I think he still has his right eye, but it's so damaged he still can't see at all. It's horrible. Mm-hmm. But he was able to make somewhat of a recovery, and, like, I'm glad that there was a fund to help pay for some of the costs, but, like, he had to have a bunch of different surgeries, and that's not cheap. And, yeah, ugh. That's just the side of it that, like, I didn't see in college, because I didn't really read the full article in college. I would just see, like you said, it was all over Twitter, and people were just quoting, like, oh my god, there's a zombie, and I'm like, what? And I never really looked into it further, but, like, these are real people, and, like, it's awful.
I feel like that's how a lot of these stories are. Like, everybody just sees, like, one snippet, and, like, that's everything they remember, but they don't know the actual details.
Right, and even this is just scratching the surface. Like, this, there's definitely more to it, and it's crazy. Yeah, but you don't hear about bath salts anymore as much.
No.
Yeah,
which is also weird. Well, I feel like there are so many new, like, designer drugs out. Like, the toxicology report back then couldn't test for it because this was such a new drug. They didn't have a way to test for it in the labs. And I feel like that's the case for a lot of drugs coming up in the streets today. Like, the lab that we work with is really good in, like, developing tests for drugs they know they're going to see more and more of.
Yeah.
And, like, we've seen a couple of new drugs come back in, like, toxicology reports, and we're like, okay, like, this is gonna be the new, like, cocaine or fentanyl.
Yeah, it's definitely. Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I feel like certain drugs come in and out of, like, I don't want to say fashion, but, like, popularity.
They come in, like, phases.
Yeah. And also, the thing with bath salts is, and, like, testing for it, like we said, it covers several different drugs. It's not just, like, bath salts isn't just, like, one drug. It's, like, a variety of drugs that have similar effects. And so, it's, like, how do you know which drug you're looking for? You just think it's bath salts, but you don't know which form of it it is, and it's... I'm not a toxicologist, so I could just be making all this up. But I know it's, like, it's not just one drug. It's not like bath salt is one drug.
It's a combination of
several different. Yeah, it encompasses. It's like an umbrella term for a few different drugs.
Don't turn into a zombie.
Don't do drugs. That was, like, a thing people would say, like, in my college. Like, people were so unserious, and they'd just be like, "Hey, don't do bath salts." And it's like. For real, though, don't do that. Like, for real, unjokingly, don't.
Someone comes up to you on the street and offers you bath salts, say no.
This turns into a dare podcast. Like, don't do drugs.
You have that in high school?
I didn't, actually, or at least I don't remember it. I was talking to Costa about this, like, recently. He was talking about it. He's like, yeah, we had a dare program, and he knew what, like, each letter stood for. He was, like, reciting it to me, and I'm like, I had no idea. They didn't tell me this. They didn't tell me anything.
So I didn't have a dare program. I went to a Catholic school, like, my entire life. My sister had a dare program, but she only had it because she went to public school for a portion of, like, middle school, and she had it there.
Maybe I did have it, and I just, like, did not pay attention. I just, like, didn't remember it.
I remember because she had a dare shirt.
I know. Those are, like, I remember seeing those on, like, other people that, like, I didn't go to school with. But I don't remember having a dare program.
I feel like that should be mandatory in a bunch of schools.
I feel like it didn't work, though.
Like, it definitely didn't work. It made you want to do more.
Yeah. Did not
It was
work.
Like, oh, an authority figure is telling me no. So, to end this episode, we tallied a total of 1 green flag and 3 red flags. So, in our opinion, this episode of iZombie does not pass in terms of forensic accuracy.
But it is fun.
This is really fun. Thank you guys for suggesting us to watch this. Everybody should go watch this because it's just an all-around fun show.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any other show or episode suggestions, please feel free to, like, DM us on Instagram, email us. We're always open to watching new shows and giving you guys what you want to hear. So thanks for listening to this episode of Inside the Morgue. If you like this podcast and want to learn more about forensics, keep on listening. Feel free to like, subscribe, share with friends, follow us on Instagram. It would all help us out a lot. We'll be back next week with a brand new dissection. Bye!